Show, I have to first start with a compliment. I mean, the book is just fantastic. I couldn't put it down, which I know our listeners know that I don't say that about all the books. There are a lot of important books out there. In fact, I'm going to have to do a little comp assault here. I'm not sure it's the most important book about the Clintons. I think Clinton Cash by our own Peter Schweitzer might still be the most important, but this is an infinitely better read. This is you're a fantastic writer, and you do such a nice job telling the story of the Clintons. It's almost like a thriller to go through it. So, first of all, talk to us about the importance of that, the fact that it's just entertaining.
Well, I don't even know what to say after all that. That's very kind of you, Alex. Guilty as Sin is a book that may sound like it's an easy read, but, you know, I do a huge amount of research. I've probably done well over 200-300 interviews for this book.
Wow.
And then, of course, as Nora Ephron, the now late Nora Ephron, used to say, all good writing is rewriting. And so this book has been gone through my computer many, many times. And if it's a thriller, it's because I've really tried to make it accessible, make this book, Guilty of Sin, accessible to a large audience, because the message is very important, which is that Hillary is guilty of sin, has been guilty of sin, and if she becomes president, you can bet your bottom dollar that her 4 years will be one Hillary Clinton scandal after another, because wherever they go, the Clintons trail scandal behind them.
You know, there's a bunch of topics that I want to get to, and I know our time here is short, but first, quickly, let's talk about your background, because people who are loyal listeners to the show, I've interviewed you a couple times before, they're familiar with your work, but for people who might be new to the broadcast, and we know there's many of you, your background, here are your right-wing bona fides, Ed Klein. You're former editor-in-chief in New York Times Magazine, and you've written dozens of stories for Vanity Fair. So that's where your background is in media. And really, you started to report on the Clintons extensively for books in about 10 years ago or so. And all of a sudden, the media starts turning on you. And it's only places like our show or some of the shows on Fox where they'll give you a fair hearing. Talk about that.
Well, it's very interesting that you bring that up, because when I was at the New York Times, and that's a long time ago, I left the New York Times, believe it or not, in 1988. That's back then, the New York Times, it's hard to remember, it was a straight newspaper. It was not in the tank for the Democratic Party. It was a straight newspaper because the executive editor of the paper, Abe Rosenthal, had a famous saying, "I don't care if you cover the surface as long as you don't sleep with the elephants." And he meant by that, obviously, that you could cover, you know, the Democratic Party, that's fine, but you can't get into bed with these people. You have to have fairness and distance and detachment. And that's the way it used to be, and that's the way I was when I was there. Now, when I write about Hillary and Bill and the Clintons and what they have been up to in this new book, Guilty of Sin, I am bringing the same journalistic ethics to bear. These are facts in this book, and the facts speak for themselves, which is that Hillary, in fact, did jeopardize national security with her unsecure email server, that Barack Obama knew about it all along during her time as Secretary of State and didn't do anything about it, so he was complicit in this, that she and Bill Clinton don't even live in the same city, no less, in the same house, and that Bill has his own little love nest down in Little Rock in his library.
I'm glad you bring that one up, Ed Klein, because that was one of the couple highlights for me, was going into some of the details, and we know you have impeccable sources. You're going to get unfairly criticized for using anonymous sources because you're going after the Clintons.
Well,
if you're going after...
Don't forget that the Game Change guys who wrote...
Yes.
They use nothing but anonymous sources.
Right. It's
Bob
an unfair double standard.
Nothing but anonymous sources.
And not to mention...
You can't write contemporary political books without using anonymous sources, because people won't talk to you otherwise.
Well, it's a, you have stories like Breitbart's been dogged by BuzzFeed, for example, who has who's on a jihad against us, which is fine. We don't like those guys either. They report on us with anonymous sources, and it dogs us for years because the mainstream media repeats it. They're 100% falsehoods that are provable falsehoods. It doesn't stop them when it suits their political narrative. But that's a discussion. We could spend the whole day on that. Right. I want to talk about the love nest, because that is that what happens at the Bill Clinton Library in Arkansas would shock people. And this book, Ed Klein, it goes up to as recently as really just a few weeks ago. It goes up to September of 2016. The information is completely current. You write about Bill Clinton's love nest, how he even wanted to put a pool on top of the library in Arkansas. Talk to us about how he uses this as essentially a bachelor pad.
Well, basically, the national media has ignored Bill Clinton down in Little Rock, where he spends almost half his time. I went down there and I interviewed two interns who worked there, and they're in their 20s. Both of them had been invited up to his penthouse apartment on the fifth floor of the William Jefferson Clinton Library, where he has this luxurious penthouse apartment that he uses for parties. And both of them have given Bill Clinton foot massages, no less. He kicks off his loafers and his socks, and they massage his feet. Now, he planned and had an architect look into building a swimming pool up there on the fifth floor so that he could have naked pool parties the way John F. Kennedy, his hero, used to have in the White House. And the National Archives said, no way, we're not going to let you do that, so it never came to fruition. But he does, according to a source that I have who was at one of these parties with him, take out a garden hose from time to time and spray down these women in a kind of a wet t-shirt contest.
I have to hit the cough button to stop from laughing. It is hysterical, and it's incredible to read, but it's also quite scary because we're talking about putting this family back in the White House. In terms of, but I still think the most important section of the book, and there were many, you go through incredible detail, the email scandal, in particular, James Comey's history, also a really good read, that section. But the palace intrigue between the Clintons and the Obamas, which you wrote about in Blood Feud, but you reiterate a lot of it with some new moments. The one thing that I think you actually broke news in noting that Barack Obama and the Obamas were well aware of Hillary Clinton's health issues, that they've been concerned about it, and in fact, that might have actually led them to support her, thinking they could perhaps have another shadow presidency. And you note, which is a great point, that Barack Obama staying in Washington, D.C., the first president since God knows when to do that. Talk about the palace intrigue.
Well, it's very interesting because, as you know, there was a blood feud between the Obamas and the Clintons, which, as you say, I wrote about. But after Barack Obama was unsuccessful in getting Joe Biden or Elizabeth Warren, the Looney Tunes senator from Massachusetts, to run for president, and he tried very hard to get one or the other, he was stuck with Hillary Clinton. And as a result, it's either Hillary wins or Donald Trump wins. And if Donald Trump wins, obviously Obama's legacy is going to be wiped out, including Obamacare and a lot of other things. So he's thrown in his lot now with Hillary. But he's aware of the fact, keenly aware of the fact, that Hillary's health is very frail. He, in fact, offered her the use of the Walter Reed National Military Medical Center to have a checkup. He said he'd let her get in there secretly and nobody would know about it, but she said no thank you because she has her own doctors in New York City where she goes periodically for checkups for what I'm told is a leaky heart valve. And Obama was very instrumental in persuading Hillary to tap Tim Kaine as her running mate. And the reason for that is that Tim Kaine, who used to be a Clinton loyalist many years ago when he was governor of Virginia, backed Obama in 2008 against Hillary during the primaries. So he is a Obama man, Tim Kaine, not a Clinton man. And so if Hillary should falter because of her health in the White House, if she's elected, the Obamas have a, what you might call a mole or a Manchurian candidate or whatever you want to call Tim Kaine there so that they can have huge influence over the course of this country and the Democratic Party.
Ed Klein is my guest. He is the author, best-selling author of the new book, Guilty as Sin. He was kind enough to break the cover art with us at Breitbart.com. The book is absolutely fantastic. He is the editor-in-chief of New York Times Magazine, contributing editor of Vanity Fair. It's really a current history and a great summation of a lot of the Clinton scandals, particularly with the emails. But explaining some of these details with your sources, Ed, and you clearly had to do dozens and dozens and dozens of interviews for the book, but pointing out that the Obamas, well aware of Hillary Clinton's health issues and, in fact, could be using those to his advantage as he stays about a mile from where I live is where he's moving in.
He's renting Joe Lockhart, and he used to be a press secretary in the White House. He's renting this huge home in the Kalorama section of Washington. The Obamas are. It has, I think, 8 bedrooms. And there's room for Valerie Jarrett there. And it has room for 10 cars, and that's very unusual in Washington.
Very.
So this is kind of a White House, a second White House in Washington with Obama, with clear intention of continuing his influence over the course of this country in the next presidency.
Ed Klein, thank you so much for joining me. I know you, I'm told you have a hard out, but this is an important book that I would recommend if there's anyone. This is a great book for fence sitters. This is a great book for people who might not feel like they can stomach Donald Trump, because Ed Klein's a man from the mainstream media. He's not someone you describe as a right-wing kook like you might hear on you can't just besmirch his bona fides as a journalist the way the mainstream media tries to do with a lot of other contemporary writers. This is a good one for people to read. They can get through it in a day or two, and they'll enjoy the read, and they'll learn so much about the Clintons, the Obamas, and what we have in store unless Donald Trump becomes the next president.
This book, Guilty as Sin, is available for order on Amazon.com and on BarnesandNoble.com, and it's only, I think it's going for about $16, which isn't a lot of money.
Yeah, definitely.
Oh, and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. It would appear Russia and the United States are moving down the path towards some kind of confrontation, even conflict. With the war of words coming out of Washington directed at Moscow, is there still time to de-escalate? Crosstalk Russia-U.S. Relations. I'm joined by my guest, Michael O'Hanlon in Washington. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Also in Washington, we have Larry Johnson. He is a managing partner for Berg Associates and a former CIA analyst and U.S. State Department counterterrorism official. And in Oxford, we cross to Mark Allman. He is the director of the Crisis Research Institute in Oxford. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I very much appreciate it. Let me go to Mark first in Oxford. There's been a torrent of a war of words flying back and forth. I have to say, at least from my perspective, a lot of it is coming, initiating in Washington towards Russia on a whole variety of fronts right here. Are you worried, and that's the whole primary question of this program, are we moving towards some kind of confrontation, even conflict, between these two countries and its allies? Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, I think we've passed the stage of the initiation of a new Cold War. We're actually, in some ways, rather like the atmosphere before the First World War. Michael Howard, the famous historian of the 20th century conflict, said, don't read the diplomatic papers if you want to understand why the First World War broke out. Read the newspapers, read the opinion articles, read the atmosphere of belief that it was now or never on the part of the Germans, that somebody had to make sure that they're not going to be pushed around. And I'm afraid, for instance, watching the British news media as well as following American media, we get CNN and Fox and so on in Britain, one has a fear that the atmosphere has been created that it's a game of chicken. And yeah, it's a game of chicken, not just that the United States has been pushed into saying to the Russians, you must back down over these issues, but also American and British politicians are being threatened by the media that if they don't show they're tough, they'll be the ones who are chickens and somebody will be pushed in their place instead.
You know, Michael, you know, there was the term during the Cuban Missile Crisis that became very popular, brinksmanship. Are we in an era, in an atmosphere of brinksmanship right now? And we can talk about some of the specifics later. Go ahead.
Well, let me say, first of all, I think Mark made a good point about the analogy with the period before World War One. In some ways, and I think where he and I may disagree is sort of who's to fault, who's to blame right now. I think both sides are to blame. But having said that, I think that's a very smart analogy. And we do need to worry about the way in which seemingly small or relatively unimportant crises can snowball. And that one can feel like if I give in on this, I'm not going to be able to protect my real core equities on something else. So I fundamentally agree and share the concern that he's expressed there. Having said that, I also think, for all my differences with President Putin and my lesser but still real differences with President Obama, I think they're both smart individuals. I think they're essentially maneuvering in some ways geostrategically. The situation is tense and fraught, but I don't expect either one to actually take us over the cliff to war. So at the end of the day, I'm not losing sleep over this, but during the waking hours of the day, I am working hard on it. I am concerned about it. So I'm at sort of a middle level of anxiety.
Okay, I guess maybe we can all agree that Putin and Obama are level-headed people. Okay, fine. I think we would agree with that. But I have to bring up an example then where the Pentagon attacked Syrian forces, a gross violation of international law, probably a war crime, and Obama didn't fire the Pentagon chief. I mean, these are the things that I worry about here, okay? And, of course, it wrecked the ceasefire. Go ahead, Larry.
Well, the problem we have is there is a lack of strategic vision on the part of the United States. I think from Russia's perspective, there is, or at least what I see from Russia's perspective, there is a clear strategic focus on their part. They're trying to stop the spread of Islamic extremism in the Middle East. They're supporting a largely secular government. It is not a sectarian government in Syria. What the United States has done in concert with Saudi Arabia and Qatar has been supplying arms, money, and training to radical Islamists, claiming that we're fighting a war on terror against Islam, radical Islam, but at the same time arming and equipping them to take out a secular government. And it has been the United States that has been engaged in cross-border activities that violate international law, not Russia. And so what I'm seeing from a rhetoric standpoint, it's not just rhetoric. It's the way articles are being phrased, framed, and presented. You saw Martha Raddatz the other night in the debates. She presented what I'll call the neocon position in describing what was going on in Syria. Now, I come at this from the standpoint, when I was at the CIA, I did work for a time on the covert action against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan, and as we were planning stories and shaping media, and that's exactly what I'm seeing taking place right now in the United States, in Great Britain, and in Europe. There is a desire to cast Russia as some new aggressive international power that must be stopped, and, you know, that's beyond nonsensical. That's crazy.
You know, Mark, the atmosphere that we have right now, I think your analogy of before the First World War is very good. But we can go to 2003 and the build-up to the illegal war against Iraq. I mean, Western audiences were prepared for a conflict in that country. This time it's Russia, but Russia isn't Iraq, is it?
No, I think that's a danger. And I think, to be fair to some parts of the elite, we've seen people like John Sawyer, the person appointed by Tony Blair to be the head of our intelligence, MI6, and other senior figures who were involved in Iraq, saying that this is much more dangerous. If we are to go down the path of confrontation with Russia, it could well get out of hand. And I think one of the differences with the classic ideas of the Cold War, say the Cuban Missile Crisis or whatever, is that we have all these other players, these allies, but who aren't necessarily held on a firm leash. The Soviet Union during the Cold War was in charge of its allies. To the great extent, the United States could slap down its allies, as the British and French discovered in Suez in 1956.
Yes.
But now, we're not entirely certain that the Saudis, the Qataris, the rich Arabs are entirely playing by what the Americans want. After all, they have ways of influencing American opinion through donations, through their own media, just as people will say, well, Russia has its ways of propagandizing its point of view in the West too. But I think the danger is that we have too many people playing a game, and then we have institutions in the West. So are, for instance, the Pentagon, the CIA, the State Department really on the same page? Is that not a problem that complicates any attempt to resolve these issues, that you have distrust now on the part, say, of the Russian military, that there are some people in the American military who want to take down two or three Russian planes just to show them who's boss, who's really top gun? And, of course, there must be the fear in the American side that those Russian missiles in Syria might take down one or two U.S. planes just to show what they can do.
You know, Michael, that's a very good example, and this is what I've been worrying about now for the last couple of weeks, is that, you know, it seems to me the United States just wants to deny Russia any kind of a diplomatic victory or leverage here. I mean, and that's at the expense of the Syrian people. And we saw the second ceasefire collapse. We saw such a war of words coming out. I mean, Samantha Power, I'll just say, just embarrassed herself and the United States with her rhetoric. It was just uncalled for. And then all of a sudden, the U.S. says, well, we're going to sit down with the Russians again this weekend and talk about Syria. I mean, where is this all going? I mean, it's almost kind of schizophrenia. I mean, what do you want and what do you expect the Russians to do? I'm asking you what the U.S. government, that's not to you directly. Go ahead.
Well, I think we're going to have to compromise. You know, Mark and Larry made some fair points. Mr. Putin has a fair perspective. On the other hand, President Assad created a system of government that produced the riots and the uprisings in 2011 that were largely indigenous. It's true other parties in the area and to some extent the United States assisted those as time went on. But Assad has also carried out most of the barrel bombings of neighborhoods.
That's not correct.
I want to finish this point. I would like to finish this point and you can have your say. And so we're at a point now where we have a complete chaotic situation. We're going to have to compromise. I think the clear compromise is a confederation model, a Bosnia-style model, where Assad could still be in charge of sectors of the country that are primarily Alawite and Christian, and there is a new confederal government. Assad is not a good guy, and you can try to pretend he is, but he's not.
Okay. Larry, that's called...
I'm not maintaining it. That is a partition.
What Michael just said there is a partition. He said used a different word, but it's a partition. I think the country should stay whole and sovereign. Go ahead, Larry.
Well, no, look. What Michael's ignoring is the fact that the CIA was involved for quite a while, predating Barack Obama. And it was under George W. Bush, where the direct interaction with opposition elements in Syria. And we're not talking sitting down and chatting. We're talking money. We're talking training. And then we're talking the passing of arms. The United States and Saudi Arabia and Qatar were directly involved in provoking the confrontation. Bashar al-Assad, I'm not saying that he's Mahatma Gandhi, but he's not this great source of evil. He does not have a sectarian government. He has a secular government. He allowed Sunnis, Shia, Christians to exist in that country without being religiously persecuted. And then the United States decides that it's going to intervene and help provoke this conflict. All of this has to do, ultimately, with the fact that when the United States destabilized Iraq and the Iraqi government became decidedly pro-Iranian, that Iran shift has shifted everything in the Middle East. And this is all about trying to contain Iran. This has nothing to do with trying to bring justice to Syria. That's the propaganda. And if you doubt it, just take a look at Max Blumenthal just recently had an excellent piece where he exposed this Ayman Ashraf, who is a billionaire. He's in the oil and gas industry, and he's been actively involved with helping sow propaganda around the world to present the White Helmets as this beneficent group, when in fact they are Islamists. And we're not talking about the peaceful Islam of Cat Stevens.
Okay, I'm going to jump in here, gentlemen. We're going to have to go to a short break here, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Russia-U.S. relations. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing the increased tensions in Russia-U.S. relations. OK, Okay, Mark, I'd like to go back to you in Oxford. I'd like to reflect upon what we heard from Michael and Larry here. Again, I this is a very complicated conflict in Syria. We would all agree here. But I think the objectives should be relatively simple. They are simple. Russia and the Syrian government want to destroy terrorist groups and foreign influences in Syria. Fair enough, it's a sovereign country, even if you don't like Assad. But the United States continuously goes back to the political transition that it calls, okay? I mean, that's why we have this tension when it comes to Syria, because we have two different different goals. And it seems to me the simplest way for a political transition to happen eventually in Syria is to end the civil war, the proxy war, and end the terrorism there. That's the priority. That would solve it. But there's no political will in Washington to do that. Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, I think we've got this problem of so-called double containment that the Americans used to have with Saddam Hussein and the Ayatollahs of Iran, now applied to Syria. They want to, as it were, overthrow Assad, but also fight against Muslim fundamentalist terrorists. Mm-hmm. Now, sitting in Europe, I'm afraid Assad is not really a threat to the security of ordinary people in Europe, but we have seen repeatedly in the last months and even in the last few days the risk of Syrian inspired terrorists coming back into Europe to attack us. And this, I think, is part of the problem of not being able to have a clear idea of what is the relative problem. It may well be, in my view, that in fact, if you want to get rid of Assad, you'd be wiser to help the civil war come to an end in order that those people in Syria who don't want to fall under fundamentalist Islamic rule, but who perhaps would then want something a little different from what they had in the past, would be able to separate themselves safely. At the moment, if you're a Christian, if you're many Kurds, if you're a Shiite, and also if you're a Sunni who, after all, the majority of Sunnis still live under Assad's rule, you have to ask yourself, if he falls, will I be safe? Will I be blamed as a supporter? We've seen attacks on Armenians in the ISIL-controlled areas of Deir Ezzor and so on. So I think there is a risk that the incoherence of Western strategy is feeding a chaos, because we don't want to admit that we have two incompatible objects, and maybe we have to admit that one of our objectives wasn't achieved, probably isn't achievable, and may not even be desirable if it is achieved, because the overthrow of Assad would actually open the door not to Jeffersonian democracy, but to the very kind of fundamentalists who would be on a roll and feel that they could roll on over the Golan Heights, perhaps towards Israel, roll on towards Europe. So I think we have to ask, who is the enemy that threatens the West, as opposed to who is a bad guy, because there may be no saints in this conflict, but there may be people who are not a threat to us, and there are some who are.
Michael, those are very good points. You'd like to reply to any of them? Go ahead.
Yeah, I agree with enough of what Larry and Mark have just said that, first of all, I would acknowledge the United States was still trying to work with Assad before 2011. You may recall Secretary Kerry, when he was still senator, he went to Damascus and he used the phrase that Assad could perhaps still be a reformer. There's no doubt that in the grand scheme of the Middle East, Assad, through the early period of the Arab Spring, was seen as not that bad. You know, we didn't like the fact that he tolerated or even condoned or even occasionally supported Hamas and Hezbollah, but overall he was not seen as one of the top promoters of violence in the region. Things changed in 2011, and I'm just worried that it's too late to go back to putting Humpty Dumpty back together. The entire Sunni Muslim world has watched Assad barrel bomb neighborhoods. I think the best we can hope for is some kind of a confederation. That way Assad does stay in charge in some of the large cities, but you have Sunnis governing Sunnis in the primarily Sunni areas in other parts of the country. I think that is the only plausible way to wind this thing down.
But, I mean, this conflict has created the sectarian differences, Larry. That's, you know, Syria existed with many different kind of communities in relative peace compared to the rest of the region here. I mean, it seems to me that, you know, you should go back to where we were before, where there was relative peace without all this foreign interference in the internal affairs of Syria. This is what it gets down to, and the U.S. just refuses that. I don't know why in the world the United States has to determine who's legitimate and who's good and who's bad in the world. This is called politics. Go ahead, Larry.
Well, I wouldn't mind the United States making some judgment about good and bad if it was actually using a very clear objective standard. But it is a very subjective standard that is applied. And I want to reemphasize the point that the U.S. policy right now towards Syria is being driven almost entirely by Saudi Arabia. We are subjugating U.S. national security interests to the interests of the Saudis. The Saudis are terrified because Iran has emerged as a resurgent power in the region. Well, the reason that Iran is in that position is because of U.S. actions, particularly in Iraq. When we got rid of Saddam Hussein, when we got rid of the Ba'athist Party, and when we installed leaders in Iraq that had been on the payroll of Iran, that were protected by Iran. So, you know, this sudden shock and amazement that Iran's influence has spread, and that's where it is so disingenuous on the part of many U.S. policymakers to pretend that all of a sudden Bashar Assad started doing something that demanded our intervention. I mean, that's just utter garbage. It started when the United States went along with France and the UK in getting rid of Muammar Gaddafi because Muammar Gaddafi was threatening their oil interests. U.S. did a 180 on a guy that he had been a state sponsor of terrorism, but he at least gave up his weapons. We turned on him. We've now turned on Bashar Assad, and the people of Syria are paying this horrible price, but it has been inspired by a U.S. policy that is not driven by strategic vision. It's really driven by craven economic interests, in my view.
Well, okay, I think it is quite ideological. Mark, if I can go to you, because it seems to me the U.S. and its allies are willing to keep fighting this conflict till every single Syrian has died to give Russia and the Iranians a bloody nose. They have no interest. I really have no patience for bringing democracy to Syria. Why don't you bring democracy to Saudi Arabia? I mean, this is just ridiculous here. It's about geopolitics. Go ahead.
Well, this is the absurdity, isn't it? We are, in a sense, ignoring the elephant in the room, which is the Arab despotism of Saudi Arabia and its little allies in the Gulf, who are, after all, waging a very brutal air campaign in Yemen. And they are, at the same time, promoting democracy in Syria and in Libya and so on. How can these places that don't have any pretense of representative government be taken seriously? And I'm afraid this is the great problem for the West. We're getting, if I can use another analogy from history, into the 1930s. The British and Americans talk about spreading democracy, talk about their principles, but as the Japanese foreign minister said back at that time, they're like poker players. They've won all the chips on the table, and now they tell everybody you have to play a more moral game like contract bridge. And we are seen as hypocrites because we are in bed on one side and supplying weapons to the Saudis and the Gulf Arabs to do in Yemen pretty much what we condemn as atrocious in Syria. And we may not be able to see that we are speaking out of both sides of our mouth, but I'm afraid to say you don't have to be a bright kid in the Middle East to know that. And so it's true that there is a religious divide between Sunni and Shiite. There is a potential civil war across the Middle East, but also I don't think whoever wins that, if it came to it, would necessarily say, oh, now we can be friendly to the West. I think the West is in danger of discrediting itself, and that is a very long-term problem that we are seeing after the victory of the United States in the Cold War, after the triumph, if you like, of Western ideals, as it were. They are more and more discredited. Many people who go in Russia, I was in Russia only a few weeks ago, you know, now do not really take seriously Western protestations, even when occasionally they may be factually correct. They just say, well, we've heard all this from these people for 25 years.
You know, Michael, when the second ceasefire was agreed to for Syria, after a seven-day period, there was going to be a judgment if Russia and the United States could work together to destroy some terrorist groups. Do you think that's why that quote-unquote accident happened, is that the Pentagon simply doesn't want to work with Russia on anything? Because it would legitimize Russia, and that's not politically correct in the atmosphere in Washington these days.
No, I don't share that interpretation, Peter. First of all, you're right that there is a fair amount of concern in general about the U.S.-Russia relationship and about Mr. Putin. But I don't think that that's driving Syria policy. The one thing I would say, I mean, I agree with a lot of the critiques of American Syria policy we've heard here today, but I don't think they're aimed at Russia. We were screwing up our role in this war way before Russia intervened a year ago. And so I think we have been, and Mark got at it, we've been trying to pursue these simultaneous goals of defeating ISIS and displacing Assad, but trying to displace Assad with a little bit of military pressure and then a lot of diplomacy, which hasn't worked. And I think we've been floundering. And, you know, I actually think we need to generate a little more battlefield leverage, not against Russia, but on the side of the more moderate of the insurgents.
Well,
I don't see any
other
way to get
people,
to the
Mike,
negotiation
who are the,
that
who
I'm
are those people,
about.
Michael? Who are those people? Can you identify them for us?
Well, we we have certainly the Kurdish force. We have certainly most of the southern front, which is unfortunately fairly small by comparison. We have about a half dozen other groups that are studied, for example, in the Institute for the Study of War paper in April of this year. Now, there's a lot of judgment, you're right, as to who's unacceptably hardline and who is more moderate. But I think the United States spent 4 years not helping the moderates very much, and a lot of them got killed off, or a lot of them wound up having to associate with al-Nusra.
Okay, Larry, moderates, if they exist at all, they have the cover of Nusra and other groups like that. I mean, that's why they stay there, okay? If they separate from them, they're actually meaningless, okay? The al-Nusra and its allies, those are the people fighting there, and they have foreign backers, and they're terrorists.
Well, look, Michael is correct that there are some elements in Syria that are not radical Islamists that oppose Assad, want to see him go, and are willing to fight him. But unfortunately, they are nowhere near a majority. They're actually a very, very small minority. The groups that are actually conducting the fighting, the groups that are involved with producing chemical agents and using chemical agents on the battlefield, are the radical groups, the ISIS and al-Nusra. And the U.S. intelligence community knows this.
Yep.
And they know it because they're able to track who's actually doing the fighting. And, you know, the real irony here is Russia is operating in Syria under international law. They've been invited by a sovereign government to come in and conduct operations. It is the United States that's violating Syria airspace. It's the United States that's violating international law. And I think Mark's point was spot on. We talk about wanting to promote democracy, yet we subsume ourselves to the Saudis. One of the main reasons, look at the billions of dollars of weapons that they're purchasing from the U.S. defense industry. This is really has a lot more to do about money than with any strategic vision. This is about keeping a U.S. industry sector going.
Okay, Larry,
that's terrified
on this,
the war on terrorism doesn't have a lot to
do. On this point, we've run out of time, gentlemen. Fascinating discussion. Many thanks to my guests in Washington and in Oxford. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next presidential election. I'm joined by my guest, Michael Flanagan in Washington. He is president of Flanagan Consulting and a former congressman. In New York, we have George Samueli. He is a fellow at the Global Policy Institute of London Metropolitan University and author of the book Bombs for Peace. And in Los Angeles, we cross to Mac Zilber. He is a Democratic strategist at Jacobson and Zilberg Strategies. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I very much appreciate it. George, if I go to you first in New York, well, we're calling this program a final stretch, but maybe I should call it a campaign of smears, because it seems to me that's what the news outlets pick up the most, is one smear, one insult, one right after another. I think in political science they call it a bloody shirt campaign.
Yes, that's what it has been. But one has to really go back to the beginning. Donald Trump entered this campaign with a very distinct set of issues. It was quite an original mix. Trade, immigration, an end to foreign interventions, and a working partnership with Russia. And he had abandoned many of the old Republican ideas that have been largely discredited and have proven themselves to be losers in past elections. Republicans have lost 5 of the last 6 presidential elections, such as entitlement reform. He abandoned that and came up with this new mix of issues. The response of the media and political elite has been almost from the start one of smears. I mean, there's been very little attempt to debate him on the issues, but it has been an attempt to smear him. One of the most powerful smears so far has been the allegation that he is somehow working for the Russians. He's a Russian agent. He's Putin's cat's paw. An absolutely scurrilous campaign, which many of the liberal media have put forward with very little evidence to support it. Okay. And now, I think that having that particular strategy having failed, they're going for the sex angle, or bringing out all sorts of things such as the tape. And doubtless there's going to be more, you know, maybe women coming forward with allegations that he had talked crudely to them or he had grabbed them or whatever. But that is largely the attempt to destroy his campaign. So whatever else you can say about Trump, the response to him has been one of smears.
Okay, let's hear a response from Mac in Los Angeles here. How would you respond to what we just heard from George? Go ahead.
Yeah, so the notion that Donald Trump has been campaigning on a lack of foreign interventions, first off, is almost a 180-degree polar opposite of how he's been campaigning. Donald Trump has said that he will, quote, bomb the hell out of a number of countries in the Middle East. He has, several times in 1 hour, asked his military advisors, why can't we use nuclear weapons? Why can't we use nuclear weapons? Why can't we use nuclear weapons? As for the question of Donald Trump's affiliation with Russia, his prior campaign chief, Paul Manafort, received north of $10 million in cash payments from the pro-Russian political party in the Ukraine. Donald Trump, just a couple of days ago, quoted a claim that was only made in Sputnik, a Russian-controlled newspaper and or radio, online media source, and had not been republished anywhere besides Sputnik and one small Turkish publication. There's no way that that information could have gotten to his campaign unless his campaign was monitoring those sources.
Okay, well, that's an interesting take there. Michael, why don't you jump in there? Because, you know, I started relatively early in this program about Trump being a surrogate for Putin. I mean, Vladimir Putin has only said one thing about Donald Trump, and I was present when he said it in St. Petersburg of June of this year. He said he was a colorful figure. That doesn't sound like a surrogate to me. Go ahead.
Well, our young friend in Los Angeles has his talking points down pat. There's no question about that. Unfortunately, it's like most of the Clinton campaign. It's kind of made up as they go along. Donald Trump's interest in Russia is to have a normalized relation with a world superpower. And this is very novel for Americans. Russia is the Soviet Union, I should say, has been our great bugaboo for decades and decades and decades. But the Russian people have been great friends and will continue to be so for a long time. And to normalize relations with them in an interest of world peace is something that President Clinton, or I'm sorry, President Bush thought about, didn't do much about. Hillary Clinton talks about in a reset, but doesn't do much about. And I think a President Trump would do this in a very useful and effective way. The Middle East is much closer to Russia's backyard than ours. We're close to energy independent. We don't need their oil any longer. And so much of the problems in the Middle East, largely from our adventurous foreign policy under the Bush administration, for which I do not apologize for, but I do question in a large part, particularly the reconstruction, I think that President Trump will have a much better working relationship with the Russian, working toward the benefit of the people of the Middle East by wiping out the terrorists that are there and allowing good people to go back to their lives and go back to their countries. And I think that's his goal. I think that's the goal of most Americans.
You know, in Georgia, again, you know, Vladimir Putin was asked about working with the next president, and he said that, I'm paraphrasing here, that Russia will work constructively with the United States, and the last name doesn't matter. Again, I don't understand why the liberal media keeps pounding away at this here. Oh, and we'll talk about the email scandals and hacking as well. Go ahead, George.
Exactly so, because what Putin has also said is that, well, wouldn't it be kind of foolish for us not to want to work with somebody who wants to work with us? Why would we be critical and hostile to somebody who said, I want to have a good working relationship with Russia? Well, of course, Russia will say, yeah, we want to have a good relationship with the United States. But, of course, when Trump has questioned some of NATO's strategy, he's doing something that American politicians should have done 25 years ago, with namely to ask, what exactly is the purpose of NATO? Why do we need this? Why is NATO continually expanding? And so Trump has said, well, if there's something useful that we can get out of NATO, then let's get it out. But otherwise, there's no point in just simply committing ourselves to something that is doing nothing for the United States and is doing very little for other NATO members. Now, this is, of course, causes outrage among the foreign policymaking elite. And the only way that they can respond to his perfectly reasonable criticisms of NATO is to allege, oh, well, that he's doing it because he's Putin's man. It's all part of a nefarious Russian plot to sabotage and undermine the Western alliance. There's no attempt to argue the case as to what exactly is the purpose of NATO. Why is it in existence? Why is it expanding? And instead, it's just the response is smears.
You know, Mac, I think, and I want to point out to our viewers here, is that Russia and the United States have significant differences on many foreign policy issues around the world. Let's be clear about that, okay? But at the same time, when, you know, the first major leak of a Democratic National Committee, we had, you know, the head of Clinton's campaign came out instantly and said it was the Russians' fault. How did he know that?
Well, the United States has come out in recent days and said that they're relatively confident that these hacks are the meddling of Russian officials to try to sway American elections. And regardless of the merits of Donald Trump's NATO policy, which I personally disagree with, I think that it's important that we defend our allies, and it has nothing to do with, you know, any adversarial relationship to Russia. But nonetheless, regardless of the merits of Trump's NATO policy, it's clear that the reason that hackers in Russia are trying to hack the Democratic National Committee's emails, recently John Podesta's emails, to influence the election, is because of the fact that they want someone with Donald Trump's NATO policy in office.
No one knows who hacked John Podesta's emails. We don't know that yet.
The United States just came out and said that they believe Russian hackers hacked the emails. I have it right here in front of me.
Okay, this is from the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. I'm glad that Mac brought it up here. Let me just read it very quote. Just two sentences here. The U.S. intelligence community is confident that the Russian government directed the recent compromises of emails from U.S. persons and institutions, including from U.S. political organizations. Here's the germane part here. The recent disclosures of alleged hacked emails on sites like DCLeaks.com, WikiLeaks, are consistent with the methods and motivations of Russian-directed efforts. That is an evidence-less statement. Go ahead, George. That's what was said. No evidence whatsoever was presented. That is an empty statement with no evidence. Go ahead, George.
Of course, because they're a national intelligence agency.
Go ahead, George.
Yeah, the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, has absolutely no credibility. This is a man who should have been indicted for perjury. The man perjured himself before Congress 3 years ago when he declared to a Senator Wyden that there is no bulk collection of data on Americans. And then he had to force to walk it back and said, whoops, well, I actually misspoke. There is bulk collection of data of American citizens by the NSA. This is a man who has no credibility whatsoever. He lied under oath. He should have been indicted. So now we're going to listen to him, particularly we've listened to all the nonsense about Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. There's absolutely no reason why we should go on believing assertions by directors of national intelligence.
Okay, hold it. Michael, jump in here. We're going to go to the break soon. Go ahead.
Peter.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Let me get in real quick. I was born and raised in Chicago. I was raised in the Chicago way of doing business. I was raised in the Chicago machine. I know it inside and out. The idea of the Clinton campaign saying this is to get you to talk about the Russians and is it possible and James Clapper and the other things. And you have great answers to all of that. The reason that they bring it up is because they have to distract from the fact that she lost her email server control of it to whomever, and she doesn't know who she lost control of it. And as long as we're talking about some foreign government trying to invade the emails, we're not talking about her failure to secure her own emails or even those of the DNC. It is a way to get you to not talk about her failures and to talk about somebody else's bad actions.
Good. Okay, gentlemen, I have to jump in here. We have to go to a break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on the U.S. presidential election. Stay with RT. Where all things are considered, I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing the final stretch to the November election. Mac, I'd like to go back to you in Los Angeles. I want to make something very clear to all of my guests and our audience here. I am not making the statement that Russia didn't do the hacking. I'm not, because I don't know. I don't have the evidence, okay? Having said that, we had the James Clapper also come out and say over the last few weeks during these episodes is that the United States is hacking Russia every single hour of every single day. Now, if a foreign government tries to hack the United States, that's something, it's like a mortal sin, but the United States does it to everybody all the time, everywhere. I mean, it seems to be really, you know, there's this kind of immoral equivalence is being played here. Go ahead.
Sure. Well, I'm not going to be one to defend every aspect of the United States foreign policy. I mean, I personally am a lot less interventionist than a lot of folks who are in power. I personally would not like to see as expansive a drone and surveillance program. That being said, there is a difference between using these tactics for intelligence purposes and using these tactics to sway the outcome of a foreign election, which the United States has done in the past. I mean, who knows how recently, certainly in the 70s, there's been some elections where that, you know, the United States played a very heavy role. That being said, when it's our domestic election in, you know, one of the oldest democracies in the history of the world, where we have this unbroken string of peaceful transitions of power, the idea that other countries are trying to become involved in our elections, which, you know, it's a very concerning thing to a lot of voters. I mean, we've seen a lot of polls where, you know, around 70% of Americans are at least somewhat concerned about Donald Trump's close relationship with the Russians because, you know, it's Russia is not the United States' adversary. I'll make that clear. But nonetheless,
well,
there are cases where we're going to be geopolitically at odds.
We're quickly going down that path, okay? Quickly going down that path, very unfortunately, I'm afraid, particularly when it comes to Syria. You know, George, you know, the United States does influence elections all over the world. Ukraine is one of the most recent ones where the United States, you know, it had parties banned. And so you take out that entire political spectrum, okay? I mean, they're influencing elections all of the time. You know, and you know what? I'm going to maybe startle some people. That's what countries do. They try to get their way here. But saying one country has the right to do it or shouldn't be criticized for doing it, you know, that's a totally different thing. And I think going back to the media here, you know, creating this scarecrow of Russia in Russian media, in Western media is really unwise. Because you know what, George? Because Russia is not Afghanistan, it isn't Iraq, it isn't Libya, it isn't Syria. It's a nuclear power like the United States. And I think Western media should be far more responsible. Go ahead, George.
Exactly so. And you brought up the example of Ukraine. I mean, that was the Western intervention in the electoral process in Ukraine was very stark. The West has clearly been intervening very heavily in Russian elections. I mean, the record is quite extraordinary. I mean, going right back to the 1990s, the 1996 election, I mean, the U.S. government actually boasted that it actually secured Yeltsin's election. I mean, boasted. I mean, it was featured in Time magazine.
Saving,
you know,
Boris.
Thumbs up.
Saving Boris.
Yeltsin elected. Yeah. That's right, saving Boris. So the whole idea then, and of course they've been doing it more recently. I mean, you know, you could ask what the Russians think of recent elections in Russia. And indeed, I mean, the U.S. government is pretty much making clear that they want to get Putin out. And you can be pretty sure that in the next elections the U.S. is going to be heavily involved in trying to get Putin out of office. So the idea that the U.S. is getting United States getting indignant about anybody's intervention in our elections is laughable. But also the policy that Trump advocates, which is improvement in relations with Russia, is an inherently intelligent, sensible policy. I mean, it's something that everybody should be thanking him for. Yes, we do need to improve relations with
George.
Russia. We need a partnership with Russia makes sense at all levels. So there's nothing to be hysterical about.
Well, I mean, unfortunately, there was the U.S. and Russia could have worked together in Syria, but it looks like Ash Carter didn't want that to happen. I think you know what I'm talking about. Michael, you want to jump in? That's the point of the program.
Sure.
Go ahead.
Yeah, the complication in the Middle East is that we have longstanding allies in Israel or Saudi Arabia to one extent or another who we are not using. We have new allies in Iraq who we abandoned to ISIS. We have old enemies in Iran that we have empowered, all in an effort to kind of stabilize the region, which has done nothing but destabilize it. What we need are powerful allies to come in and straighten the mess out. Russia has to be on that list. Turkey has to be on that list. Some argue Iran needs to be on that list, but the Persian-Arab difficulty over the years is very difficult. What I'm saying is Mrs. Clinton thinks that we can have an army of Arabs that are going to go in and do our bidding with our support, and it'll get done. And it won't get done. It has never gotten done. That has never worked. What we have to have is a good working relationship with the Russians, with the British, with the French, with outside forces, with the UN Security Council to come in and do these matters. And we are on our way to a good relationship with none of those people. And that is the problem. And Mrs. Clinton has no plan to get us there. I don't know that Mr. Trump does either, but okay. He's open to it. It's a goal of his. It's a desire of his. And it's a place he wants to go to.
You know, Mac, one of the historically speaking, one of the last times that it was called the Soviet Union then, that was played a prominent role in an election. It was in 1960. Remember the missile gap and how the electorate was terrified that the Soviets were ahead? It was a complete myth. It didn't exist. If there was a gap, it was reversed. The United States was far, far ahead of the Soviet Union. But it was an election ploy. Now, and the Clinton people are doing exactly the same thing. Every time there's an email release, don't look at the content. Try to figure out who exposed it, and then blame the Russians. I mean, it's such a patently simple formula, okay? Secretary Clinton has a record. We should have a right to know what that record is, okay? I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And then all they do is just say, well, it's Vladimir Putin involved in it. I mean, this is red baiting of a different kind, and it doesn't do anything for the electoral process. As a matter of fact, it just shuts out speech. That's what it does. It intimidates people. Go ahead.
Well, that was an interesting question. I'm glad you brought up the missile gap myth, because ironically it was Donald Trump at Sunday's debate who said, quote unquote, Russia's getting ahead of us in nuclear now, and you know, kind of a fragment statement. So there's a little bit of this red baiting going on both sides. And you know, needless to say, I mean, the United States, while you know the U.S. should continue to have nuclear disarmament, you know, we have not fallen behind, you know, in any kind of meaningful sense in that regard. However, on the broader question, I mean, Hillary Clinton is not focusing her campaign on Russia. I mean, this
really?
Is a very small component of a very broad campaign where she's talking about paid family leave, she's talking about increasing the minimum wage. I mean, we're all talking about these negative attacks because that's,
you know,
what sells on
but
the
you
press.
Know, but
I mean,
Mac,
today, Hillary
but
Clinton
Mac,
released
don't you
a
think,
brand new policy
don't
on
Don't you think
tax
it's
credit.
Fair, though? I mean, if you look broadly, I'll use your word here, if you disagree with Camp Clinton, you must agree with Vladimir Putin. That's the message that's being sent, and it's ludicrous. You know, I mean, the Russians here, I've been living here for 18 years, and Russians are just absolutely bewildered how their country and their president has been pulled into this election. They're bewildered by it. So am I.
It has nothing to do with if you disagree with Hillary Clinton, you must agree with Camp Putin. What it is that if a major party nominee says that another foreign power's leader is stronger than our own president, which both Donald Trump and his vice presidential nominee
maybe
said,
in terms of character,
how would Russians feel if they had a domestic politician who, A, had an American political consultant who had received over $10 million from our president, who, B, was, you know, saying that our president was stronger than theirs? I mean, I think that there would be some discontent there. I mean, it has nothing to do with, you know, anything except for the fact that in most countries, people are parochial,
about a hypothetical. I'm talking about what's really happening. Michael, you want to jump in there? Go ahead.
Right,
yeah,
what's really happening,
which is that we do have a candidate whose political consultant
received $10 million from a foreign
And that was in Ukraine. That was Ukraine. Everybody says the pro-Russian.
Not only was it in Ukraine.
American
political people.
All right, George, let Michael go in Washington. I love programs like this.
The American political. I'm in Washington. I'm among this crowd that makes a living doing this, and they work elections all over the world. Obama for America was involved in the Israeli elections just last year. So I mean, let's not go to that place that you took a job so you're a bad person. This happens all over the world all the time, and foreign people come here and take contracts too.
Yeah.
What the question is. And the question that you were relating to earlier was, how do we get to a resolution in this election? How do we get to November 8th, and what crystal ball or what do we got that's going to take us there? And here is, if I can kind of diverge from Russia for just a minute and talk about this election, which is why we came here, this is how I see it breaking out. So I'm going to take us to a whole new place here, if you don't mind.
Okay,
I've got to
all right.
Take over your show for just a second. this is how I see us getting there.
30 seconds.
My desperate desire to learn to be a host myself.
You got 30 seconds.
30 seconds. Mrs. Clinton, I'm working it. Mrs. Clinton, however good or bad Mr. Trump is doing in the polls, and right now he's done better, I'll tell you that, but she can't get away from 43% to 44%. People don't leave Trump and go to her. They leave Trump and go to undecided. They leave Trump and go someplace else. She can't move her numbers. So her only goal is to shrink the pie, to have smaller numbers, and that's to dirty up Donald in such a way as people stay home. And that is her path to victory. If she can't do that, she cannot win, because 43% is not going to win
this
election.
All right.
So this is her challenge, and that's why it's as dirty as it is.
Okay, fascinating. Gents, we've run out of time. Many thanks to my guests in Washington, New York, and in Los Angeles. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, crosstalk.